This is tape four, side one of the oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder, October 11th, 2005.
We were talking about the documentary films and Michael Camry. As I recall now, the proposals that we sent in, he had conceived to shoot essentially from the plains to the intermediate hills to the high levels of Nepal or the Himalayas. With the notion that at different altitudes you had different kinds of ecology and flows and such stuff. Not very bright, but anyway, it would be photographically interesting to do this. And that was what we had sent to all these people, these three films on different altitudes in South Asia. The one that came back that had any hope was from the Office of Education again, and they said that although they weren't particularly impressed with the films that were laid out, they were interested in films that would be produced with some sort of guarantee that they would be distributed. Because so often documentary films would be made and then they'd stay in the person's garage or attic and they weren't acceptable. So there were sort of two requirements. It should be usable for people teaching courses. So that there was a clientele out there who would say, wow, here's a film that we need. That would help. And then if there was some distribution mechanism so that it would be available that people wanted it, that would be important.
Joe, what year is this?
1970, about.
Okay.
I think. I can tell you, when did the first film come out? Okay, this would have been the early 69, 70, something like that. We began looking for money. Then back came a letter saying we were authorized to make three films. Well, this was just great. We'd picked the idea of pilgrimages because in the lecture on pilgrimages in India, it turned out that there was nothing that we could use and the pilgrimages are sort of spectacular. So we were going to make these three films. It took us a while to sort of get ourselves mobilized, the money had to come and all the rest. And by that time, we'd run into a graduate student, a woman named Meera Binford, who was in communication arts. She was a little older, she was in her 30s somewhere. Had been to India. She'd been married to a man who was working in India, and then they'd gotten divorced. And she was interested in working with the project. She spoke a little bit of Hindi and Marathi, I think. So that Michael and Meera went out with camera and stuff to shoot the film on three different pilgrimages. And off they were. Okay. It was, the mechanics were very complicated. You shoot over there, but there's no place to develop them, so they send them here, and then they had to be developed. And once they were developed, then you made a work print, because the original print you kept in virgin form until it was time to cut it. So we had this whole process of films coming in. They didn't know how well their stuff was turning out. It would be weeks or months before I would see what was coming out. So the stuff just piled up here, with these three films almost simultaneously being done. They finished in a couple of years, came back, and then we're on the Madison campus editing these things and trying to put them together. We ran out of money. We had way underestimated how much it was going to cost. So we crawled back to the Office of Education and apologized for the fact that we needed more money, and they came up with a little more money. They'd also shot one film just coincidentally. They were in India when the Bangladesh War broke out. And all our sympathies were with the Bengalis because of the way things had worked out. So even though we had money for three, if I recall, they felt that if they scrimped a little on the three and shot some of the footage in Bangladesh to get what a country was like as it was trying to identify itself, even though that wasn't in the original proposal, that would be something, taking advantage of what was going on. So they had gone into Bangladesh sort of the first year afterwards. We talked to Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, the Prime Minister, who was the hero of the thing. He was quite intrigued at the thought of having a Wisconsin crew come and film him and his dreams for Bangladesh and all the rest. So we scrunched the money around so that they could get their visas and take time out from the pilgrimages, which are tricky because, you know, pilgrimages happen at certain times and don't happen at certain other times. By the time, then we ran into a problem with one of the cameras. It jammed, so that's what they sent us back here. This was all old, you know, problems with customs and what have you. Got it repaired, sent it back there. So they didn't actually begin interviewing him until about June of, this would have been 73. By then, Bangladesh was going sour. The dream of democracy had faded. People were increasingly resentful of Sheikh Mujib. the sadness of people who hope this wonderful dream of an independent Muslim Bengal, now watching it be just about as corrupt as it had been under the West Pakistanis or under the British. So the film that they shot, which ultimately was one of the four that came out, dealt with perceptions of a whole lot of people of the failure of a dream. And ironically, Sheikh Mujib did not want to be interviewed by them. He said we could film in his office, and so we have a shot of him talking with people and stuff. But I think he was aware that stuff was going sour, and it wasn't quite his great public publicity show that he wanted. Several years later, when the film was edited and we announced we were going to show it, the events happened where there was a massacre of him and his whole family in Angers. So within the period of him leading Bangladesh independence and our film coming out, the country had simply gone completely upside down. People were relieved to see him dead. There was very little reaction to the fact that he was assassinated. But that was just one of these coincidental things. So the pilgrimage films came out. They took more. They cost more than we had intended. They were very well received. People hadn't seen anything like it in terms of the color and the narration. This was not Hollywood. This was people talking about why they were on the pilgrimage and stuff. So we were like drug addicts, led on into doing more and more of this. And one thing led to another, and I've been now the executive producer of some 20 documentary films with various crews doing the filming.
You did not know anything about film, to speak of, when this started.
I knew.
You learned on the job.
Pretty much. We had a family camera and had movies of the kids as they learned to walk. I mean, that's the level of filmmaking that I had. On the side, we have a whole bunch of corny family movies. We had the kids, whenever there's a family reunion, we'd have the kids act out Snow White and the Six Dwarfs, or Ali Baba and the Four Thieves, or How the Grinch Stole Christmas, or whatever it was. So we have a whole series of funny home movies, but that's a very different league with a wind-up 60mm camera. The serious stuff was, I felt, really fulfilling. I mean, when you get a good shot and you're looking into somebody's eyes who's describing a meaningful experience, that's about as close as you can come to conveying to class the kind of stuff that you're trying to convey. So Michael and Mira went out and made another series of films. They're laid out in the whole syllabus here. And I think to the extent that I'm invited to go to places as the visiting speaker, it's to be as the filmmaker to show clips from various films I've made. You know, here, the five that I typically show, illustrates a different point. One indicates action which the camera caught, which we missed entirely. There's a case of a Brahmin whose nephew is ill, and he's asked a low caste sorcerer to draw out the evil spirit and get rid of it. So you have this odd thing of a high caste Brahmin and an untouchable sorcerer involved in this exorcism kind of activity. As the exorcist was about to touch the forehead of the Brahmin's nephew, it occurred to him that he didn't have permission. And in the flick of an eye, he sort of says, okay. And the Brahmin says, okay, and the hand keeps going down. Now, you could describe that, but to watch it, that this was absolutely built in, you know, the notion that he was about to touch somebody that might be offensive and to get the clearance, was one of those things that the camera's smarter than the eye, we wouldn't have gotten. And a series of things like this where the camera enables you to do stuff which you couldn't have otherwise done through sequencing. So anyway, to the extent that I'm the visiting speaker at a gathering of some kind, often it is to present a new film or show clips in various films and indicate how useful these things can be. And
these films are still widely used, aren't
they? They're widely used. We distribute them from the center now. Two summers ago, we converted them all to DVDs because we went from film, 60mm, which are big and bulky but nice, to VCRs, which are easy to use but they lose 25% in clarity and stuff, to DVDs, which are a little better than the VCRs, but they're not the original. When I show the DVDs, it's simple, you slip them in and they're projected on the screen. And the comparison between that and hauling in a 60mm projector and putting in the plug and running the wire to the speaker, which is the way I used to do it, is the difference between night and day. But
really,
I keep seeing the crisp, beautiful image that are there on the film, and the DVDs just don't catch it. So I'm still making documentary films. Usually the camera, the only camera work I did was with one of the pilgrimage films, where I was actually in Madurai, and there's a big fence festival every spring where the goddess remarries the god and they circumambulate the temple and so on. Well, Michael and Mira had shot wonderful footage of the film itself, of the festival itself, but they wanted some shots of the same location when the festival wasn't on. So on my winter trip, they gave me the camera and a set of shots to take.
Oh.
And so Joe Elder, amateur cameraman, with the soundtrack and all of us went out there and played with their equipment and shot, oh, maybe the equivalent of 45 minutes of stuff, which could then be cut in. This is what this particular shrine looks like on a normal day, and here's what the shrine looks like when it's in the middle of the pilgrimage. But that's the only footage I myself have shot. The rest of it has mostly been getting the idea, getting the funding. We've gone to practically anybody who gives money for the funding.
Mm-hmm.
The Smithsonian Institution has helped out. The Office of Education has helped out. The Rupees helped out for a long time here.
Oh, really?
A lot of money from them until they, in fact, they helped get us launched until we were such big beggars. They finally said, look, back away there. One film costs $125,000 and we could give five fellowships to people and you're cutting out the field.
When you started talking about this, you said the Office of Education said they were interested if you could guarantee or you had some sort of distribution network.
Right.
How did you address that?
We did it, and again, I give credit to Michael and Mira. We have the center, and the purpose of the center is to make the presence of South Asia visible and accessible. So they watched how the football operation in Wisconsin occurred, how the budget was set up, and then reproduce that so that there was a separate account which could run negative balances, as the football account sometimes runs, in order to fund an ongoing project. Now, I give them entire credit for searching the mechanism around here to see how you could create something like that so there was a budget line where you indicated each year what you thought the income was going to be and what the expenditure would be. And if you ran a deficit for a few years, it wouldn't be the end of the whole world. You didn't want to happen very often. So the center became a distribution center, and that's still one of the big things that as you walk into our center here, and in the side room, they probably have 150 copies of the film, both in VCR and DVD form right now. And a constant advertising that goes out. The big conferences we have, the stuff are laid out there. People can order it through email and all the other kind of ways these things are ordered. So we're in the business of distributing documentary films.
Mm-hmm.
Each one has its own story, and I certainly will not tie up the tape with each story. But most of them were filmed by students of mine with whom I've worked. Several of them were students who went on the college year program and would do their fieldwork project as a film. And then that would become one of our film series, or they'd subsequently work with me on another film because we'd worked together and it worked out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent, then there was one that that an anthropologist identified in an area of India called Mithila, where the women draw very characteristic paintings of the gods and other creatures on walls and on floors. And eventually they started putting them on paper and selling them. And this thing, which is now called Mithila Painting, we made a couple of films on the Mithila painters.
Huh.
And the whole subsequent process of getting money to the women painters that we may have time to get into later on. But anyway, the person who got me into that project and convinced me that there was filmable material in there left a lot of stuff which was not a film yet. And so that was one where I took the bits and pieces with some drafts that he put together and edited that down and narrated that. So that was one that I put in much more time in the actual creation of it. And the last two I've worked on were filmed by an Indian documentary filmmaker named Sudhir Gupta, but for Indian audiences, and much longer, 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Hmm.
There was enough useful material in there for a class in the States, but somebody had to introduce it and trim it down so that it would fit in with a 40-minute classroom. So the last two I worked, I've been essentially working with Sudhir Gupta's material, where the premise is that everybody knows what he's talking about because he refers to the gods and locations in India. And there's I said, there's enough good stuff there. So with some beginning stuff in my initial narration, then we get into his stuff and it works out okay.
Joe, while this is going on, what are you teaching in sociology?
Okay. I began as sort of the theorist. Any department has to have courses in theory. So when I first came, there were two basic theory courses, one essentially social psychological theory and the other essentially collective theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught both courses. I was stronger in the collective stuff, but I could do the other. Which meant that I met every graduate student in the department because they all had to take both one or the other of the courses. Then there was a feeling that that was artificially constructed, those who deal with social psychology and those who deal with collectives. So they were reorganized into an undergraduate course dealing with the classics, Max Weber, Emil Durkheim, Karl Marx, and then a graduate course which dealt with them in much greater detail, plus another series of theorists. So for probably a quarter of a century, I taught every theory course that was taught. Sometimes other people would teach them also, but this was sort of my backbone, which meant that I also was drafting the theory prelim exams, which everybody had to take. The fun thing was that I met every graduate student. That had began to change after other people began to teach theory, and then I began to teach other kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I also taught courses in the early 70s. We began to get interested in sort of development sociology, what was happening in the third world, which was kind of natural for me.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed a course called the Sociology of Economic Change. And we called it economic change because development had the AID concept that we are going to go in and reproduce in India or Pakistan or Nigeria patterns that exist in the West. And we wanted to be free to look at the Marxist patterns and cooperative patterns and all the rest. So we called it the Sociology of Economic Change Program. And so I taught the basic graduate level course there for quite a while.
Huh.
And we actually got funding from the National Institute of Mental Health, if you would believe it,
really?
To set up a training program. This is again when money was around to do specialty training in various varieties of sociology. So this was to train people who would learn how to gather data and do research in parts of the world where you didn't have good census figures or voting records or something like that. You sort of went out there and there was a village and there were tribes and how did you do it? So I was the director of that for a while and there were others who were directors of that. One thing that we did, each year one of the faculty would take a group of graduate students to a developing country and do a research project in the developing country, which was really hands-on.
Okay.
And one took them to David Wiley took them to Tanzania, I think it was, and then John Delamater took them to Yugoslavia, and I took my group to Nepal, and that was the way I got introduced into Nepal. We ended up living in the dry jungle area and doing a study of land settlement there. It was exciting and fun for me because I was taking people who would never have left the United States probably and putting them into a situation where they're talking with real people through translators and trying to figure out what actually goes on when you're dirt poor and you're trying to make certain decisions with limited finances that you could never get in the United States. So that was another kind of specialty that I developed. So the two areas in sociology were theory on one hand and sociology of economic change on the other. Then in South Asian studies, I sort of was given anything that I could teach. There was an introductory course on the civilizations of India, which was a year-long course. This is kind of basic introduction. And from the very beginning, I would teach the modern period of that. And Henry Hart and I would switch off. He was a political scientist.
And what is the modern period?
Beginning about 1600.
I suspected that I was.
Good question. It wasn't the day before yesterday. But the classical period would deal with the Vedas, back in the misty past, and go through the Gupta period, the Maurya period, and the period when Buddhism was pretty much the dominant country, up to, say, 10 or 1100 A.D.
Okay.
And then the Muslims came in, and things began to change, and so on, and the Europeans came in. So that was a course I taught. Henry and I would swap off. I'd do 2 years, he'd do 2 years, I would do 2 years. And then when Henry retired, I taught it every year, sort of the modern period. And the classical period is taught by a Sanskritist or a literature person, and so a student who takes the course has a huge span from give or take 3,000 before the Common Era up to the day before yesterday in the modern period.
Uh-huh.
We turn it backwards. We teach the modern period first semester. Guess why? Because we use this as a lure to get students to sign up to go to India. The classical period is just too far back.
Yes.
And the modern period, which I'm teaching right now, I say on day one, look, my purpose here is to have a half dozen of you be in India next year at the same time. And I'm not going to conceal the fact that if you want to go to India, if you want to learn about India, you better go there. You can look at the films, you can read stuff, but you really have to go there. And so it's been a major drawing source for the course. And the class cracks up because I periodically sort of put in a dig. For example, they're required to read a book on Village India, which is, the last chapter is written by Susan Wadley. And I said, guess how Susan Wadley first went to India? She went to India in the Wisconsin River. Guess how this person who made this film got to India? They went, so they're just, it gets to be a giggle topic. Everybody Joe talks about went to India in the Wisconsin River. But it does work.
Uh-huh.
Then I was allowed to encourage to put in specialty courses on India that are cross-listed in South Asian Studies and Sociology. The survey course now is in Sociology, History, Political Science, Geography, and Indian Studies. So people can have it listed under a whole lot of things. A lot of the area courses like Africa and Southeast Asia will be cross-listed in a variety of disciplines. So you get quite a mix of students. It's a pain in the neck to turn the grades in because 16 go to geography and 32 go to history and 11 go to political science.
But I'm sure.
We can live with that. So the courses I introduced, the first one was called Social Structure of India. And this is an effort to see how the caste system emerged realistically, not the way I thought it emerged.
Uh-huh.
And then look at what the government of India is trying to do to introduce, to level the playing field, because there's a great deal of concern. The government is aware that there is a caste system and there are huge inequalities. And there are idealists who would very much like to level the field and even this thing out.
Is there any progress being made?
Limited progress in some ways, dramatic progress in others, no progress in others. It sort of depends how it works out. But
uh-huh.
Here's a country wrestling, realistically, it's built into the Constitution, that something has to be done for the fact that about 22% of India's population has been in a despised category for
yes.
centuries, and how do you do something about that? So I bring it in and contrast it at times with what equal rights had tried to do in the U.S. We can't have quotas in the U.S. India mandates quotas. And so it's a very different exercise that you go through in terms of how do you hire people and how do you get representatives in parliament and so on. So it's, you have different tools.
Oh, even parliamentary seats?
If there are 22.5% what's called scheduled castes and tribes in India, there are 22.5% seats in parliament that must be filled by people from scheduled castes. It'd be as if we said that 10% of the Senate must be black, 10% of the House of Representatives must be black, because 10% of the U.S. population is black. And then how do you decide who's there and who doesn't? So it's a challenge, you know. And it's a huge experiment in its own way.
Is it working? Is the government, is the legislature in India supportive of this?
Certainly in principle, you know. And the representatives are, they're there to speak for the scheduled castes and tribes. But you're dealing with where's the money and where's the power and all the rest. So you have real forces at work, some of them blocking some others. But the thrust is always there, and the Constitution mandates that this thing has to happen. So it's even a notion of social engineering. It's an interesting country to
look
at. And then the fact they have had a series of democratic elections, which are more or less democratic, and a few countries have managed that. So how does that work out? So there's a lot of really exciting stuff. So that's, I would say that probably is the most specialty course I teach. I don't think there's another course in the United States that quite matches that, and that's my personal focus. Then early on, I decided to teach a course on Gandhi, which spins out sort of from my Quaker background. I was uneasy to get into it because the notion of teaching somebody who's a great saint and, you know, how are you fair and accurate? Well, Gandhi as a person and as an intellect is very, very interesting. He'd be almost impossible to live with. I think if I were in the same ashram with him, he'd have been such a pain in the neck. But I deal with him as a real person. He's under observation a lot. He has some strange ideas. He made historical inaccuracies. I mean, but his technique of active nonviolence and the way in which he exercised this and tried it, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, makes a fascinating narrative. And it's sort of like each class, now we're going to talk about the effort to do this and the effort to do that, and when he went to jail and when he fasted and so on.
Do you ever get Indian students here on campus who take that course
always,
on Gandhi?
Always, yeah.
Oh, and how does that go? Do they challenge you?
Mostly they know so much less about it than I do that they don't challenge it very much. What I do is lay out as accurate as I can the things that he did and the effect that he had and the weaknesses that he had and the way he irritated people, the things that he said that were wrong. As you would do if you were writing about any philosopher or any historical figure. So on one hand, they learn much more about what he was doing. It isn't just very simple, you know, nonviolence does everything all the time. On the other hand, they realize that he wasn't a wonderful person, and he did make, in every instance, and he made some pretty appalling mistakes. Often mistakes which he himself was quite willing to acknowledge. And there's a vast amount of literature. Stuff keeps coming out every year, more stuff on Gandhi. It just never seems to dry up. So that was the second course I introduced. Now, the third course I introduced came after the crisis in Iran, when the American embassy personnel were held by the Iranians. And I was walking from parking lot 34 to the office, and somebody had spray painted on the sidewalk, "Nuke Iran." There was a lot of anger about Iran. And, well, nuke Iran was sort of, you know, the six-pack answer to Iran. But I thought, if somebody here thinks that that would solve anything, and I know something about Muslim societies, I have a responsibility to give a much broader picture of what Islam is all about. So I did get a semester's leave to read up on Islam, which I had never studied particularly carefully. I had grown up in a Muslim country, but those compound walls pretty much insulated me from what was going on. Plus the training that I had as a child, the Muslims were wrong on almost every count anyway. It never ceased to be stressed to me that Muslims committed four wives, and that was bad. Muslims told lies if it served their purpose. I mean, there was sort of my parents' evangelical attack on Muslims, which was the reason they were out there to bring the teachings of Jesus to these people who had it all wrong. So I know the Muslims never had a fair break in our household as far as what they were talking about.
I can't think of a better person to be teaching a course.
But I had a lot of reading to do because I really didn't know very much about them. There had been some Muslims in the village I studied in India, and so I picked up some stuff there. I learned more about Islam in India with my Muslim village neighbors and then a Shiite Muslim village that was about half a mile away that invited me to come to some of their, you know, quite bloody ceremonies where they would take a knife and cut their foreheads and have the blood run down their eyes and soak their shirts. Huh. And they would ask me to photograph this. Whereas when that happened in Iran, my parents would first of all describe how disgusting and horrible it was that people would do this, and then say, don't be out in the streets because they could probably murder you if they saw you. So there's all this. So a very different approach on how do you relate to Muslims. So anyway, I decided I'd have to learn a little bit more about it. So I've been teaching something called the social structure of Muslim societies every third year since then.
And is that popular?
It's pretty popular. Yeah, certainly the last several years it's been popular. And it deals with India and Pakistan, but with Islam, I'm everything to Muslims in Chicago, and Indonesia, North Africa, and Paris, and all the rest, because Muslims are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cross-listed in sociology. So a lot of the courses I teach, you can take either for South Asian Studies credit or for sociology credit.
Uh-huh.
And so it answers your question, what did I teach in sociology? Sometimes it was the social structure of India, or sometimes it was social structure of Muslim society.
Uh-huh.
That's cross-listed.
Joe, would you make some observations about the Department of Sociology, what you think its strengths and weaknesses have been over the years, and any other issues that belong in the historical record?
Sure, yeah. From the very beginning, I felt sort of honored to be a member of the department. I sensed it was good. I sensed that we could be better. And the first, one of the new chairs to come in was Russ Middleton. And Russ came in 1965 as chair. He came in from outside Madison.
Oh.
Russ was a very sort of quiet, low-intensity person who looked at the department and said, I think we could become number one department. But we need to do certain things. And he did this with Bill Sewell, who was, in a sense, the inspiration. Bill Sewell had replaced Howard Becker. Howard Becker was the one that had been so difficult.
Yes.
And Bill's stories were that when he became chair of the department, at the first meeting, they'd begun to argue and shout at each other and insult each other. And he walked out. He said, "I'm not coming back until we are going to be a civil department, because this is appalling." And the rest of his colleagues, it was a small department, maybe, if you counted the rural sociologists, the regular sociologists, maybe 18 or something like that. And he said, from now on, we are just going to...
This is side two of tape four of the October 11th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder.
So Bill changed the tone of the department. Russ was brought in, I came in, I think, as the first new faculty hire, and partly because there was money around to bring me in, because I was a South Asian. I don't think I would have been, if they just were to pick somebody, I doubt if they'd have picked a South Asian specialist. In theory, there are other, the focus was strongly rural sociology and some urban sociology, criminology, and that's where the big names were, demography. And then they began to hire new faculty. The place was expanding like crazy. I think when I came, the faculty were about 19,000. And in the next decade or so, it doubled and tripled, and buildings went up and programs got started. It was a really exciting time to be on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
So with the new faculty coming in, Russ came in to be chair, and he said, "We've got to teach fewer classes. We have to have more research time, because if we're ever going to be productive and creative, we can't spend all our time teaching." So he set out to rearrange the hours so that we could get full teaching credit by doing sort of two courses a semester rather than three.
Oh.
Depending how you pace it out. You know, a small seminar counts as a course and so on. And that was, I guess, the first time I felt here was a philosophy of quality, an organizational idea, that it's not just bright people, but it has to be bright people with resources and time. Then the philosophy of saying every time we have the chance to recruit, let's not say we must have a criminologist, we must have a demographer, we must have an urban sociologist. Let's say we must have the best. And let's see what comes in. And if we don't have a criminologist for a few years, so we don't have a criminologist. But we don't want to get a criminologist who isn't the best criminologist. And that worked out just magnificently. So these two things of reducing the teaching load and giving research time off and stuff, and then picking the brightest and sort of saying, come here with whatever you are and be as productive as you want. If possible, take off your second or third year here for your research and writing and get yourself out. Created a climate of sort of energy and enthusiasm, which I think has contributed to the sort of steady rise. I'm told now that we were about eighth in the country when I came, and we're now first or somewhere right up at the top, and have been for, which is, we've been there sort of continually. Along with these strategies, we insisted that our graduate students be well trained. And the way we did that was to insist they have more statistics and methods courses than anybody else. Now that's the ugly bread and butter stuff.
Huh.
You hate these courses. But you look good when you come out the other end. You've taken two or three courses in statistics, you've taken one course in methods. We've always had people who were very good on computer and computer methodology. And so any graduate from the center looks very good when they step out. They are well trained in the sense that they can handle the statistical kind of thing.
Joe, let me ask you, I'm not a sociologist. Mm-hmm. Why do sociologists need three or four semesters of statistics?
Because we typically work with large groups of people. We're trying to speak about, you know, the working class, or we're trying to speak about the ethnic blacks or something like that. And you're into sampling, you're into comparing different groups of people, and how do you do this when you can't take everybody?
Uh-huh.
And so you're into probabilities, you're into scales of one kind or another. Because when you're in the nature of working with collectives of individuals, mean that you are making premises about the validity of your samples. And if there's a change between 1980 and 1990, could that have occurred just because of random selection? Or is that something that has to have happened because there was a significant shift? So you get into things like significance and probability that become important in terms of how you interpret your results.
So your people really have to be grounded in statistics. They
That's
can't
right.
have just a passing acquaintance with it.
Right. And if they're going to work with large numbers, and try to make any kind of a case of comparison, they have to be able to defend their choices of samples and show that the change that occurred wasn't one that could have happened just on a random basis.
I see.
Short course in statistics.
Thank you. That's probably all I can understand, but it's helpful.
Yeah, and to read the journal articles and to comment on them, you even if you don't use them yourself, you have to be able to look at these tables and say this is significant or this isn't.
Uh-huh.
So part of the script of being a sociologist requires this. So over the years, I'd say the energy of the new faculty, the openness of the department, there were no sort of people with empires. And to the extent there were, they disappeared. Howard Becker was an empire builder, and then he left. When I came, there were a number of prominent people who thought a great deal about themselves, but they retired fairly quickly, and it became a young department. Of course, now it gets older as each year passes. But the sense that nobody has turf that they're protecting, there's no competition for students who come in, so if you work with that person, you're not going to take a course, or if you take my course, I'm not going to allow you to do that. The absence of even theoretical disagreements, it's just been unique, I think. And people keep commenting on how fortunate the department is that there aren't these divisive distinctions or turf battles that sometimes occur in the mirrors. Partly maybe because people get their own money. They're working in different areas, and a bunch of people get it from the National Endowment, some people get it from the National Science Foundation, and some people get it from NIMH. And so you're not, in a sense, if you get money, I don't get money kind of thing. You're all hustling for your own particular project. And the central mood of the department is get whatever you can, it will support you, and when you want time off, we'll give you time off. So that, again, it's a big enough department so that I don't think anybody who's asked, could I have time off to use a research grant, says, well, I'm sorry, you must teach the course on marriage and family. I've never seen that happen.
Uh-huh.
It's always, if you get money, do research, it's more important.
And I have to assume that the various deans of the college were supportive of the Middleton approach to building sociology.
They seem to have been. And in fact, I think, in fairness, we've been blessed by the deans. I think once we became good, we've been given advantages, which it was almost like giving to the rich. But we've been able to get new appointments where other people can get new appointments. The dean would start the year saying, well, you might have two assistant professors, and then we'd find three that were quite good. And he'd say, well, okay, give the third offer and see what happens. So I felt it's a privileged department, but it's one that has earned the privilege because it's been consistently good.
Uh-huh.
I think departments that haven't fared so well perhaps resented the fact that we've done so well. But I think it's also the dean's philosophy. If you've got a strong department and it's doing something right, keep it and let it happen. The department, all this, there's nobody now in the department still that was here when I first came.
Really?
I'm sort of the last hangover. There's one who came somewhat later who's still there, who's about my age, and I think she's probably going to retire in a year. I think they're saying things like that. So it's been interesting to watch the great men move on and then another group come in,
uh-huh.
who I say are probably going to be about as great. They're not quite at the same stage, many of them, but we passed through the hump of being number one and losing seven or eight or nine big names as they retired within a 3 or 4 year period, and then watching our ratings not going down as the new team came in. So I sort of was holding my breath and thinking, people may say, well, Wisconsin's lost all these folks, it's going to be a while before it retrieves it. But with some middle range appointments and a bunch of bright people, I think we're okay.
Joe, can you reflect on some of the outstanding graduate students that you have had or that the department has had that have gone on? You were talking about Susan Wadley, for
right,
instance.
Right, from the India thing.
Yeah, for the India program. Are there others from sociology that the record should reflect that strike you as particularly significant?
There are some who end up back on the campus in an interesting way. Cora Merritt, who's working as the assistant to the president right now.
Uh-huh.
I taught her once. She was in my theory class.
Really?
And then she went out, and we don't hire our own. which I think is a very healthy thing. But if our own go out and do well and get tenure or pretend to be a tenure, we'll bring it back in. So we brought Cora back in. She was in complex organization bureaucracy and stuff. A wonderful, wonderful colleague. When the Three Mile Island disaster occurred, she was selected to be the sociologist to work on the committee to figure out what went wrong in the communications so that it wouldn't happen again if there were a similar nuclear crisis. And then she,
really?
Was, and she was spotted as very bright and became the director of the National Science Foundation in Washington for several years. And I had the pleasure of going into her office, and there's this big room and a big desk, and there's my former grad student with an American flag by her, director of the center. Then when she rotated out of being the director of the National Science Foundation, she came back to the Madison campus and is now...
Cora Merritt was head of NSF?
Yeah. The science section, the social
science
section.
Social science
section.
Social
yeah,
science.
Right. So that's one that, you know, the trajectory was there. Others who ended up, I could come in with a whole list of names if I focused on them, but there were several who have come back and then have done very well on the Madison campus. Arch Haller was a person who went through here in Burroughs Sociology, and he came back and he was on the faculty for a while. Let me sort of make a list, because I'm sure I can come up with a bunch of them rather than tying up the tape at this point. I'll make a note.
Okay,
the South Asia program was innovative from the start. The fact that we had languages being taught on the Madison campus that had never been taught before. It took us a while to sort of settle down on what we would and wouldn't teach. We would do Hindi because that's a language that about a third of the people in South Asia speak some version of. But among the other area centers, such as Berkeley and Chicago and the University of Pennsylvania, should we divide up the other languages so that if somebody wanted to study Telugu, they'd do it in Wisconsin, if they wanted to study Tamil, they'd do it in Berkeley, if they wanted to study Bengali, they'd do it in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some effort to be reasonable in the allocation there. But it's always tricky because you have somebody come to Madison who wants to work in Bengal, and that's taught in Chicago, but the person they want to work with is here. So it was always a little bit rough and tumble to get this thing put together. We very quickly got a master's program in South Asian Studies and a PhD program going in South Asian Studies. And then we did innovate here and to some extent set something which I was not much of a part of. But we set up, I think, the first PhD program in Buddhist Studies here in the University of Wisconsin. Now it sprung out of the South Asia program because Buddha was born in South Asia. And if you're learning Sanskrit or Pali, Buddhism is a major tradition from the area. Dick Robinson was brought in from Canada, and he was one of these kind of innovative geniuses who was able to bring other young faculty who knew Tibetan and knew Chinese and knew Japanese and so on. And I can remember celebrating a party where the Buddhist Studies PhD program had been inaugurated through whatever the process was, and recognizing that I didn't know enough about Buddhism to give a half-hour lecture. This was not my area. But it caught fire because we had a very good set of people, to which we added ultimately a Tibetan Buddhist monk, Geshe Sopa. And the Geshe Sopa came knowing almost no English. He had been in Lhasa with the Dalai Lama and had helped give the Dalai Lama his final exam when the Dalai Lama became a Geshe, which is the PhD in Buddhist studies. And then a week or so after the Dalai Lama fled from Tibet into India, Geshe Sopa had followed him. Uh-huh. And then it had come through a series of steps so that he was here. So we attracted a wave of very bright graduate students interested in Buddhism, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism. And from Wisconsin have come most of the Buddhist studies programs in the United States right now. You pick them out and they're chairs and directors have been the product of this particular group. So that was
really
sort of an interesting thing I watched because I wasn't part of it, but I saw it happen as a spin-off from the program. We very quickly linked in with the American Institute of Indian Studies, which was established about the same time the center was established, by 13 universities, among them the University of Wisconsin, deciding that rather than having each one have their institute for research in India, they would pool their resources and have a collective consortium working together. And the consortium is kind of like a Wisconsin idea. with China and Japan, what happened, there was a Yale in China, there was a Harvard in China, there was a Yale, Princeton Middle Eastern Studies, there was a Harvard Middle Eastern Studies. Each university sort of picked out its own turf. Here, learning from that model, the new team of scholars dealing with India said, let's not go that way. Let's have a single institution, let's get funds from wherever we can, funnel up through this, give it to the best scholars, give it to the best PhD students, and cooperate rather than compete with each other. So it was a great idea. Henry Hart played a key part in getting it started. And you know, Wisconsin was one of the first ones to get involved. So they got into this public law for any money. So for a while, there were lots and lots of money for students in rupees. You had to get to India and have some way to pay your insurance and your mortgage on your home. Once you were there, there were lots of resources. So that became a major asset for people interested in studying India. And there's hardly a scholar who deals with India that hasn't at some point been funded by the AIIS, as it's called. So that was a great boon for getting graduate students going, because if you have money, there's, you know, some dream that you can actually do research.
Joe, was South Asia at this point, or Indian Studies, a department or a center?
We had here a department of South Asian Studies.
It was a department.
Yeah. Which meant chair and courses and how you got a BA and all those. In fact, a little history there. It was, when I came, it was called the Department of Indian Studies. And that's how Henry Hart had labeled it. Even the first two or three years I was here, I'd run into funny conversations because people assumed this was the Ojibwe and the Cherokee and so on. I remember having at least a 5-minute discussion with somebody from a Rotary Club who was talking about an Indian dance program they want to put on. And we were on completely different tracks. Until he got to something about it, he mentioned headdress, and I said, well, no, Indian dancers don't wear headdresses. And then all of a sudden I realized we were completely not in touch with each other. So partly to avoid that confusion, and I think there was a sense of getting a Native American study center going here, the name was changed to South Asian Study.
Okay.
That worked fairly well, because it also allowed you to talk about Nepal and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and so on. Although funny things would happen there, when you would say you're in the Department of South Asian Studies, people would say Salvation Studies? I didn't think that theology was taught on the university campus. South Asian Studies. To fast forward over the intervening decades, when the decision we made to teach Indonesian or teach Turkish or teach Turkoman or something like that, Tagalog in the Philippines, the dean never knew where to put these people, so he would put them in our department. So we ended up with this Department of South Asian Studies, teaching Turkish and teaching Indonesian and teaching Thai. And it just got more and more bizarre as the years passed, until finally about 5 or 6 years ago, we decided we just had to be honest and describe what we were. So we reorganized ourselves into the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. We approached the Chinese and Japanese scholars, because if we're going to use the term Asia, they obviously are part of it. And they decided they had no interest at all in joining us. And in a sense, there wasn't any reason. We weren't, I mean, they had their department that was flourishing. And there was nothing for them to gain by joining something where they were then competing for funds to teach Indonesian and Indian stuff. So we have this anomaly now. It's called the Department of Language and Cultures of Asia, that leaves out China, Japan, and Korea. But that's only, you know, 1.5 billion people. So who cares about that? But that has been intellectually challenging.
I'm sure.
Because now recognizing it. From the point of view of my colleagues who were in these peripheral areas, it's been a boom. And I wanted this to happen. Because now we have students coming who want to get their PhDs in Turkish literature, who want to do their stuff in Indonesian politics. And so the department has a title that allows that. And now the people who came to teach these languages can teach substance and bring in graduate students and lecturers to do the actual language instruction. So to that extent, the department looks very different, because we have colleagues who formerly were spending almost all their time teaching Thai or teaching Indonesian, now teaching stuff about drama in Thailand or Indonesian linguistics or something along that line. But anyway, that's where the title of the department has changed.
Okay.
I was chair of the department when it was still Indian Studies, I think. as soon as I got tenure, I was nailed with it. I was told that this was something that would be like it. I truly did not like it. It was way over my head. I had no idea how the university worked. I'd been insulated from how these things operated. I sort of did my work and taught my classes, and once a year was told what my salary was, and I was very well protected. Another thing that I like Wisconsin for is that I was very little of my time until I got tenure was spent in committee work. It was made quite clear that, look, we'll let the tenured people worry about screening admissions and all the rest. You keep teaching your classes and get your publications out, which I think is a very sound policy. I did watch one of my colleagues in Southeastern Studies, Jerry Kelly, who as an assistant professor became chair of the department before me, and Jerry didn't get tenure.
And part
of the reason was he felt that he was a linguist and he just couldn't get out enough publications and handle all the visits and the proposals and the kind of stuff it took. So when he didn't get tenure, he went to Cornell and ended up having a pretty successful career. But watching an assistant professor get executed was all I had to be shown that this is something you didn't do. So I was quite well protected and quite ignorant. So when I became chair, I had no idea how a lot of this stuff worked out. And it seemed as every third day there was a crisis of some kind. I can remember getting something from a librarian saying, if you don't tell us by Saturday or Friday how many yards of book space you need for books on India in the next 5 years, we're not going to allocate any. Okay. How am I supposed to figure that out? And it was constantly like this. And then there was one of these sad things where two of my colleagues got into a fight with each other and got quite offensive to each other and exchanged insults to each other. And watching two scholars who were older than I was and whom I respected as scholars act like they were kids in a sandlot was very distressing to me. I had no idea how to do this.
Uh-huh.
And it soured the department, and there were nasty charges that they went to. And I realized subsequently the world deals with these kinds of problems, but I didn't like having it impinge upon my chairmanship. The one thing that happened that was perhaps as significant as any during my year as chair was in December of that year. When
in which year is this?
This was the year I was chair, which was... So it was December of 65. I knew that salaries were going to come up somehow. I had no idea how to work out salaries. I knew that we had to work out courses, and I had no idea how to work out which courses were listed. The whole thing is very mysterious. I had a phone call from the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia saying that they were setting up a team. They wanted to have American and British Quakers go to India and Pakistan in the wake of the August War of that year, which had ended in a stalemate and a ceasefire, but not a peace treaty, to see if there were anything the Quakers might do on the subcontinent, as they had done in the days of Gandhi. There was a reputation and so on. And I just said, that sounds wonderfully tempting, and there's no way I can do it because I'm chair of the department, and a whole lot of decisions have been made in January about salaries and stuff. So I'm really sorry, but I can't do it. And they said, well, if you change your mind, fine. But we are looking. We have two English Quakers who are ready to go, but we feel we shouldn't have a national group because there isn't English reputation, and if we have an American, it cancels it. So I turned to the secretary I had, and I said something like, I just turned down a wonderful offer. It sounded very appealing, but it couldn't do just... So she said, well, what is it? And I said, it was a chance to go to India and Pakistan and see if there were anything that a team of Quakers might do to help after this war between two countries who were a single country up until a decade ago, and then there's been all this tragic ill will between them. She said, why do you say no? And I said, well, you know, salaries, courses, and all the rest. And then she said something, and again, one of these people who changed my mind, she said, well, who needs you? And I said, you mean I could leave? She said, sure, there are two or three people here who've been chair. They could fill in for you. I said, are you serious? She said, of course I'm serious. So I picked up the phone. I called them back and said, I'm coming. So that change that got me, in a sense, within a week or two to Washington in the embassy of India and Pakistan to sort of hear them say what Quakers might do, and then in the winter break go to England and team up with these other two guys, and then go to India and Pakistan and end up ultimately carrying messages between Indira Gandhi, the new prime minister, and the president of Pakistan, Ayub Khan was beyond my wildest imagination of doing anything particularly useful. But I think of it in the context of the chair because I felt that I couldn't do it, and then my secretary sort of said, with great wisdom, you are not indispensable. And so that was the chance to get involved in that. And then once having done that, it just led to a whole series of other things that I was able to do as a Quaker. So that was probably the biggest plus of being the chair, of being told by my secretary that I was totally unessential, that a lot of other people would cover, and I was covered. And I think I was getting, the second semester I had off or something, so I was able to stay until the middle of February in a series of visits back and forth, which proved to be very enlightening for me. I don't think we did a whole lot to bring peace in the country, but it was appreciated by people on both sides who had no other way of speaking with each other, because every channel of communication between the two countries had been cut off in August of 65. Prisoners were still being held, civilians were still unable to go back across the border, mail wasn't going back and forth, and part of what we watched happen was to begin to watch that stuff get unstuck. The Indians and Pakistanis signed the Tashkent Agreement under the sort of supervision of the Soviet Union, and then there was a peace treaty, and then things began to flow, but we still were useful to going back and forth,
sure,
talking with people on either side and coming up with a final suggestion at the end. Anyway, that was my brief career for 1 year as a chair.
So you were chair only for a year.
That's right.
How'd you get out of
that? The next year, I'd been invited to go to the Center for Advanced Studies at Wesleyan University. And so that was the great escape. President Vic Butterfield probably wanted me to come to Wesleyan and teach there. He was a great headhunter. And we had met someplace or other, and he sort of sensed that I was really a small college type person rather than a university type person. And he had the Center for Advanced Studies, which was a golden sort of birdcage to come. A year to write, to think, to do whatever you wanted, with only the requirement that you teach one seminar one semester, which is nothing. With a staff of people to type and to Xerox and whatever else you want. And then a dinner a week with the other fellows to talk about what each of you was doing. So it was the academic version of Valhalla, as far as you're concerned. So that was sitting there waiting for me at whatever my salary had been. So the whole family moved to Middleton. We spent the next year, which would be 66, 67, is that where you come out?
Yes, 66, 67.
Yeah, in Middleton. With a house provided by Wesleyan University and the companionship of a very interesting set of people who were working on various different types of projects. So actually it was there that I finished a lot of the work I was doing on the chapters and the lectures. We were coming out with a revised version, which was much, much more thorough and so on. And it was just terrific to have no classes to worry about. And the one seminar that I had in the spring with a group of bright Wesleyan men, we wrote a chapter collectively, which then went into the chapters on Indian civilization. This is a chapter on what happened to Western intellectuals as India opened up. What happened to philosophers, what happened to people studying religion, what happened to linguists, what happened to historians. Because
That would have been fascinating.
It was fun, and you turn a bright student loose and saying, okay, what effect, if any, did the opening up of India have on German philosophy? And so they would read their paper on what impact that had. And there was a lot of impact as these things began to come in and people tried to fit in notions of thought patterns or notions of power or notions of inherited genius or whatever they were talking about. So anyway, that was a very successful year. And some of the students that I work with, I still remain in touch with. Gabriel Campbell was one of them. And later on, Gabriel Campbell was director of the U.S. Educational Foundation in Nepal and ended up helping the students on their program, the circles within circles. So that got me out of the chair. And then when I came back, somebody else was chair, and I kept a very low profile. Eventually, that year that I was chair, I was also director of the center, which meant I was handling the $250,000 that came in for general purposes. Then in the late 1980s, pressure was brought on us to separate the role of the chair of the department from the director of the center. It was hard to tell precisely why, because it seemed to work quite well. As the center director, you got the money, and as chair of the department, you would hire Telugu teachers or Urdu teachers or give scholarships to students or whatever.
When you say pressure came, where did pressure come from?
Pressure came from Washington. They said, we don't want you just to be a center, to be a department. You're supposed to be dealing with geographers and historians and outreach and high school classes and stuff like this. You're not supposed to be, we're not funding a department. We're funding a center. And our fear is that you're converting it into a department, which probably we were, in terms of just, we need the money here and here are the students and here are the faculty and so forth. So we, with some reluctance, divided it, and then I became the director of the center and other people were the chair of the department. And right away we realized that there were lots of things that we could be doing and should be doing. The whole films operation now became a center activity.
Uh-huh.
The conference on South Asia now became a center activity. These are two big things. To the extent the year abroad program was involved, it was a center activity rather than a department activity. So there's a certain amount of sorting out. So then it didn't mean that all the money came in with the faculty salaries. It could go into staff to engage in outreach or actually be used to pay for films or pay for film distribution. So cut things in a different direction. So I remained director of the center until 3 years ago. Kept looking for somebody who wanted to replace me. There was nobody around who was the least bit interested in replacing me. And these were competitive. Every 3 years, you threw your hat back into the ring, and occasionally a center would not be funded if you hadn't done well. Washington would visit you. Washington would send other staff to evaluate you. So it was, you're constantly under peer review. You could never relax and say, well, we're sure forever that we're going to get money.
Who in Washington was funding you? Office
of Education.
Education. Staff.
Right. And they were, you know, the money came through them, and we had all the reporting process, but again, every 3 years, the sunset closed on your budget.